You know what's on everyone's wish list this year?
Oh, definitely the Bartesian Cocktail Maker.
It's like having a bartender who never judges your drink order.
Exactly. Just pop in a capsule, press a button, boom. Old fashioned, margarita, espresso martini.
Over 60 bar quality cocktails. Zero effort.
And right now, you can save up to $150 on Bartesian Cocktail Makers.
Wait, 150?
Yep, up to $150 off. It's the best deal of the season.
Okay, but seriously, how did we ever host before Bartesian?
Last time your kitchen looked like a crime scene. Sticky counters, fruit wedges everywhere.
Yeah, this year, no measuring tools, no mess, just perfect cocktails.
This year, I'm gifting one to my brother.
And myself, for research purposes.
Make the holidays easier and happier with Bartesian. Mix over 60 premium cocktails at the touch of a button. Save up to $150 on Bartesian cocktail makers. But hurry, this Black Friday and Cyber Monday offer ends December 2nd. Get yours now at bartesian.com/drinks. That's bartesian.com/drinks.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? Wash away your worries with Anabay. Anabay is the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabric. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Shop washablesofas.com for early Black Friday savings, up to 60% off site-wide, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
But now I'm going to speak about the legendary Beatles, about a new fascinating book called, if my memory serves me right, With the Beatles. It's by the brilliant journalist Patrick Humphreys, from the town where they were born. I see what you're doing there, to now and then. Good morning to you, Patrick. How are you, my friend?
Very well, thank you. Yes, bright and sunny in London.
Bright and sunny in London. As I said before, it's 54 in the car the other day. So when you see 35, I'm reminded of Monty Python, that sketch. Luxury, we had it tough. I had to live in a cardboard box and it was 65 degrees, going outside, burst into flames. Anyway, let's get on with it, as the saying goes, as my listeners are probably screaming. But every time we think that we know more about the Beatles, or there can't possibly be more to discover about the Beatles, then something like this comes along. And it's an absolutely fascinating tome. And we went through a period of time. I'm thinking, of course, of Shout, you know, and books like that, which were perhaps, what, 20 stroke, well, at least 20 years since the Beatles had split up. And now we can take an even a longer term of view and contemplate the effect they had.
Yes, I mean, it's extraordinary that, you know, we're talking about a group who last recorded together over 50 years ago. I mean, in pop music terms, that is more than a lifetime. And yet, you know, pretty well every day you open a newspaper, somebody's found a new photograph or a new recording surfaces, or the Antiques Roadshow finds an autograph. It's incredible, really. I think, and also, of course, the music. You know, rarely a day goes by when you're not humming a Beatles song or there's a Beatles reference somewhere. And that was all done really in 8 years, was their recorded career. 12 LPs and odd singles in 8 years. I mean, just an incredible story, really, even now. So, you know, writing it, like you said, I mean, you think you know everything, and you start digging into this story of how they came together, what a good manager Brian Epstein was, what a scrupulous manager he was, how lucky they were to work with George Martin, the record producer. And again, the timing, you know, the swinging 60s. I mean, it's a cliche, but it did happen, and they were the soundtrack for the 60s.
But the thing is, and what I like about this is the fact that a lot of people have, you know, when we had the Peter Jackson documentary come out, they all focus on that sort of, basically, Sergeant Pepper onwards, and no more live performances, and looking at those things of Lennon, because obviously now we know the tragedy of Lennon. We no longer have George Harrison with us, and the whole thing. But the really vital thing is this period, say 55 to 65, if you like, because this is when the Quarrymen become kind of into the Beatles and the Hamburg sessions, and if you don't, and also Stuart, of course, as well, and the photography, and it really, and it's the fact that it's in Germany, and it's really groundbreaking, and it encompasses all the sort of post-war into this swinging 60s.
Absolutely.
We don't know it's coming, do we?
No, you're absolutely right. You've got that post-war history. I mean, you've got Britain recovering from the war. I mean, I know when Astrid Kircher, Stuart's girlfriend, she couldn't believe when she first came to Liverpool how still badly bombed it looked, you know, whereas Hamburg had rebuilt itself. And the Beatles were, I mean, these were Blitz kids, you know, they grew up on bomb sites, you know, with rationing. You know, John was named after, his middle name was the Prime Minister Winston, and George is named after the King George. You know, they were British kids, and that's one angle I think has often been underappreciated. A lot of the books that have been written about the Beatles are written by Americans, and they're very good books, but they just don't get the class thing. They don't get the geographic distance between Liverpool and London. They don't get just how pinched and austere it was growing up in Britain in the 50s. And how liberating rock and roll was. And you mentioned before we came in, you mentioned Lonnie Donegan, the Skiffle King, and he was a tremendous influence. His sort of simple sing-along Skiffle songs inspired the Quarrymen, and that, you know, anybody could do it. Anybody could pick up a cheap Spanish guitar and your mum's old washboard and form a group, which of course is what John did, and that the Quarrymen begat the Beatles, and then they just went on to change the world.
I mean, I have this long the running theory that Lonnie Donegan and Skiffle is actually the original punk, because you don't need instruments, you don't need how to play, you just get there and make a racket and the rest will come.
Yes, absolutely. I think he's a pioneer who was very undervalued even today. I think the 50s is really the lost decade, and there's a lovely bit in my book where the only time the three Beatles, Paul, George and Ringo, ever played on stage in front of an audience was at Eric Clapton's wedding in 1979, and Lonnie got up with them for a couple of songs. So, I mean, that really was the wheel coming full circle.
And also, people tend to overlook, because their image was all lovely, and, you know, at least at the beginning, you know, with they were presented with, you know, the suits, because that's Epstein and the whole look, and the polished sound, which is Martin. But the Beatles, conversely, the Beatles were really tough and could handle themselves, because they'd been in Hamburg and played all these dates in strip clubs. And where the Rolling Stones, who were the bad boys, were all sort of accountancy and art college kids.
So, you know. That's a good point, yes. I mean, there's a quote from Lennon in the anthology book, you know, so as soon as you smelt woodbines in Hamburg in the clubs, you knew that the British squaddies were in and they were looking for trouble, you know. I mean, they really went through some tough times. I mean, in the books, when I interviewed Paul once, he told me about when they were in Hamburg and they went back to Gene Vincent's apartment and he pulled a gun on them, you know. It was, they were tough times. And they, of course, they're only kids, you know, they're barely out of school. And they were thrown into this world of unimagined hedonism. You know, Hamburg was a city that was renowned for its sex. You know, the long street there was just full of brothels with ladies would parade their wares in the windows. And these wide-eyed kids from Liverpool, them playing, you know, 6-8 hours a night, hammering out songs. And I think where, you know, a point is made, were they really any better than Jerry and the Pacemakers or the Searchers? And I think they were all running pretty equal at the time, but I think the crucial division came when the Beatles began writing their own songs.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to people who'd seen them at the Cavern, and I said, well, really, were they really that much better? And they said, well, what was interesting was when Paul would say, I mean, here's a song we've written. None of the others had done that. And once they started writing, I think that's when the greatness began.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, because if you look at the albums, like you look at, like, with the Beatles, and there are, like, Please, Mr. Postman, you know, Twist and Shout, these are standards, and everybody is doing that. But it's when, you know, Lennon McCartney, and, you know, it is a blessed partnership, isn't it? Because they free themselves up in a way that you wouldn't think that, you know, there was nothing to, they were hardworking, but so were all the bands at the time. They were all playing matinees and going on tour and doing these slots. But it is when those two come together, the yin and the yang, that it really takes off. But, and also, that comes to the attention of Epstein, who is looking for a project and who isn't able to do an image.
It all falls into place. I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, it was. And I still think it's incredible that one group could go from Love Me Do to Strawberry Fields Forever in 4 years. I mean, it's an incredible arc. You know, you're never going to get that again. And you're right about Brian. I mean, Brian was this sort of. You know, a furniture salesman, you know, in his dad's store in Liverpool. He wanted more, and nobody's still sure what it was about the Beatles that attracted him, but he saw something in them, perhaps a way out of Liverpool. He was a very scrupulous manager. He was very honest with them. He lost them millions when they went to America in merchandising, because, you know, 2 years before he'd been running his dad's furniture store, and people come up to him and say, well, Mr. Epstein, you know, we're going to make T-shirts and luncheon boxes, and we're going to give you 10% of everyone sold. Yeah. And, of course, to him, he thought, well, that's a really good deal, you know. And they lost millions, but he was very honest. And as I said, I think the big three, if you like, you know, was Lennon, McCartney, Brian Epstein, and George Martin. He was looking for... He was famous as a producer for his comedy records, for his novelty records, but he was very jealous of his peers who had, you know, Cliff Richard and Adam Faith, and he wanted a pop group to make hit records, and the Beatles came along, and he wasn't that impressed initially, but again, he saw something in them. He heard something, and he thought that they represented a challenge in a way. And of course, once they started making these incredible records like Sgt. Pepper and Abbey Road, you know, their imagination matched his, and which is why the music is timeless. It still sounds, you know, you can put on a Beatles record, say, from Revolver or Rubber Soul onwards.
Yeah.
And it could have been made yesterday.
Absolutely. And it's also just go back to one of the original points, because, you know, I'm loving this. But the thing is, and as I always say about this period, is them, because we go, oh, well, Epstein lost some millions in revenue. But this is the first time this has ever been done. So it's not like this.
Yes.
You know, nobody ever said, "Okay, we'll have Cliff Richard T-shirts," because Cliff Richard never made an impact over the States.
No, absolutely, you know, no. That's a very good point.
There was no
role model, and my thing about Epstein's greatness is that he got them out of the Knotty Ash Village Hall when he got them to the Albert Hall, but he got them a recording contract. None of the other managers had come anywhere close, and of course, London was again. You know, Liverpool was a 11-hour car drive away. No motorways, but London was where the record companies were, was where the media were. You had to make it in London, and that's, he got them to London, and famously they failed the Decca audition, which is not surprising. When it turned up on bootleg years later, it's not surprising that Decca turned them down, because they didn't sound great, actually. But, you know, once they got in George Martin's hands, it all fell into place.
And they're not trying to be what they're not. They're not trying to be, like, with the greatest respect to Sir Cliff of Richard, the blessed Cliff. He's trying to be Elvis. So is Adam Faith. Is Marty Wilde. But they are being themselves. They're not trying to be down home out of, you know, out, because obviously the blues wasn't fashionable until...
No, absolutely. And also, I mean, I grew up in I was 11 in 1963, so I remember that tsunami of Beatlemania.
Yeah.
And the first time I remember hearing regional access on the radio was hearing them talk, because everybody else sounded like Prince Philip on the
BBC.
Yes, indeed. Yes, the BBC calling. And they were, you know, as you say, they were a group, they were irreverent. And George Martin was used to the tradition of, you know, Cliff Richard and the Shadows, Billy Fury and the Tornadoes. Yeah. And when the Beatles came in, is it going to be John Lennon and the Beatles or Paul McCartney? And he very quickly realised, no, they're a group. There's the four of them. That's what makes them special.
Can I just talk about two albums? Well, you mentioned there, Rubber Soul, which I remember. I was lucky because my parents had the Beatles records, and it's really interesting because they've got the Beatles records from With the Beatles through to Revolver, and then it stops, which just shows that perhaps they were into the psychedelia thing. But you know, Rubber Soul, Beatles for Sale, Rubber Soul, and Beatles for Sale is my favourite photograph of them all.
Yes, it's great, isn't it?
A beautiful picture. And then you've got Rubber Soul, and that's the first hint that something's happening. And then Revolver, Revolver is a magnificent album, and you just think of the French horn on For No One.
Tomorrow Never Knows, the last track.
And that's a band working with the studio and literally not being overawed of being in a studio, but saying, let's try this.
Yes, let's try everything. And I think what's interesting about Revolver one of the reasons they just never go away was, of course, in America, the Beatle LPs up until Sgt. Pepper, the record company over there mucked them about terribly. They put tracks from one LP onto another. And when Revolver was finally released on CD in America in the form that we'd known it in Europe, the Americans were amazed. They couldn't believe how great it was. In the mid-80s, I mean, and that's a reason they, you know, that America took them to their hearts again. But I think you're right about Rubber Soul. I think they deliberately set out to make an album. I think up until then it had been the cover versions, or it was all done in a mad rush. But Rubber Soul, they took their time over, and I think it really stands out as the beginning of the if you like the second phase of their career.
Why do you think we're still talking about it? Because is it the fact that I suppose it's a yardstick, isn't it? Anytime somebody comes out. ABBA, we had ABBA mania, you know, and let's take that, and it's Taylor Swift, the new Beatles, and but there will never be another reaction. You think of the photographs of them landing back at Speke Airport, the old airport, and thousands coming out to see them. And just the way they dominated the cultural landscape for those ridiculously short, what was it, 7-8 years of recording?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think, you know, Taylor Swift actually is probably the nearest thing to Beatlemania, the scale of her success. But no, at the time, I mean, again, it was so much more, the culture was changing. You know, you had, in 63, you had the Kennedy assassination, which I remember, you know, the shock of an American president, a young American president being assassinated. It was an earthquake had happened. Then you had the Perfumo affair, which of course I wasn't allowed to read about because it was naughty things going on. But I mean, you know, the establishment was under threat, and they weren't threatening the Beatles, but they were something new, they were something different. And then America took them to their hearts. And funnily enough, earlier on we were talking about their music. And the first song they played on the Ed Sullivan Show was All My Loving, which is a great, great song. Yeah. But it wasn't a single. It was an album track, you know. And it's almost them saying, you know, okay, you like I Want to Hold Your Hand, but we've got dozens more like that, you know.
And this, I mean, you look as well at the book of the, you know, Antiques Roadshow. You interviewed for Antiques Roadshow and the appealing sort of the enduring appeal of Beatle items. If you've got the, you know, I don't know what it is, I don't know, the Beatles box set or the Beatles dinky toy or whatever, then you're...
All the stuff your parents made you throw away.
Yes.
I mean, I went to the first rock and roll when I was on Melody Maker. I went to the first rock and roll auction at Sotheby's in 1981, and I found the catalogue when I was writing my book. And you could have got authenticated Beatles signatures. I think it's £300.
Blimey.
And now it's probably £60,000. You know, I mean, it's incredible. What turns up and what's... of course, the trouble is a lot of signatures when I interviewed Paul, George and Ringo, I took along my Mono 1963 Please Please Me LP, and I got them to sign it. And I knew that George could forge John's signature really well. And I thought, no, that's a bit cheap, no. But so what I've got are the three authentic Beatles signatures, which I'm very proud of.
What do you hope that people are going to learn? Because, or is it just to get a better understanding, where they came from? Because we seem to think that they sprang fully packaged, don't we? If you don't know your history,
they. I mean, Liverpool, as I say, was a very remote place of which we in London knew little. And I mean, when the first single came out, when Love Me Do came out, the NME reviewed it saying the Beatles were a group from Liverpool brackets, hometown of Frankie Vaughan and Arthur Askey. You know, they had to remind their readers just where it was, you know. So, I mean, they grew up. I mean, the myth that John was a working-class hero was a myth. I mean, he came from a very comfortable middle-class background. But George and Ringo really were working-class. And Paul was lucky. His mum was a district nurse, so they had a telephone so she could be contacted. So, I mean, they came together. Poor old Pete Best, the original, one of the early drummers. I think it's a bit of a hard deal. I mean, everyone says he wasn't, you know, he certainly wasn't as good as Ringo. But in terms of bashing out rock and roll for 6 hours in Hamburg clubs, he was fine, you know. He was good enough. But he didn't quite fit in. He was quite a moody looking sort of character. And I remember Paul saying to me, I mean, he was fine, but he'd often go off on his own. I mean, the thing about the Beatles was we were a gang, you know, and he just wasn't part of the gang. And when Ringo came, we were a gang, you know. And that's what sort of through. And you look at that, and the four of them together, there's a great clip in the Anthology TV series where they're playing some huge American venue somewhere, and there's all these policemen looking like Rod Steiger in The Heat of the Night, you know, and the Beatles just walking through, and they just look so cool. They just look so in control, and they're the future.
Yeah.
You know, and it's bless them. They still give so much. I mean, writing a book, at the end of it, the last thing you want to do is hear any of the music you've been writing about for 2 years. You don't get that with the Beatles.
No.
I mean, you can go back to dip into the White Album, or I found myself really fond of the early songs, the ones that the critics don't ignore. But I mean, all those the sheer exuberance of "Please Please Me" and "She Loves You."
Yeah.
They're just fantastic.
And I found myself humming "Apropos of Nothing" "Till There Was You" this morning, and I know it word by word. I can't do my 12 times table, but I can do you chapter and verse with "Till There Was You."
I know, isn't that extraordinary? And when it comes to, you know, track listing of albums or covers or yeah, they're in the cover. They're one of the questions in the citizenship test now. If people want to apply for British citizenship, you know, the Beatles they're on postage stamps. You know, they are just everywhere. And I think at the end of it comes down to the music that this music they created. As I say, in that. From 1963 to 1969, I mean, what they accomplished will never be equaled. And you know, I'm sure all these new groups who are claimed as the new Beatles, I'm sure they and their managers believe it. But we know it's not the case.
And
there's only ever going to be one Beatles.
One of my favourite things doesn't actually involve the Beatles themselves. It's Live Aid. It's 1985. And a packed Wembley, Elvis Costello gets up and says, "And now I want you all to join us in a Northern folk song," and plays "All You Need Is Love."
Yes. All You Need Is Love, yes.
And that was a magical Beatles moment without having any Beatles.
Oh, I know. And you think of, I was in 1967, you just think about 1967, they did Penny Lane's Strawberry Fields Forever, which many think is still the greatest pop single of all time. They did All You Need Is Love live in front of 300 million people.
Yeah.
They did Sgt. Pepper. The year ended with Hello, Goodbye and Magical Mystery Tour on television. That was the first time they really took a stumble with the film of Magical Mystery Tour. It isn't very good at all. But the music is fantastic. And that's just in 1 year, you know. And I think that was the year that Brian died. I think when Brian Epstein died in 1960, and he was only 32 when he died.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe it. He always looked that much older. He was only 32 when he died, and he'd taken them from this. There's a writer in the book at Shea Stadium when they played Shea Stadium in 1965. It's the largest ever paying crowd.
Patrick,
55,000
I've got
people.
17 seconds left, and I'm about to crash the news. We could, if people.
No, we can't do that.
We can't do that.
It's lovely so much to talk to somebody who loves the Beatles as much as I do. Well done, mate. Well
thanks
done.
Very much, Patrick. Patrick, thanks so much. The book's called With the Beatles. You can order online.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.